As always, it's a privilege to stand in front of you tonight. I want to thank Steve and the congregation for this opportunity to speak tonight. I would be remiss if I did not add my own personal word of thanks for your presence here this evening. It's always a pleasure and an honor for me to stand here before you. On November the 10th, 1975, the Edmund Fitzgerald, which was one of the largest ships in the Great Lakes, sank. And every member of her crew died as a result of that. This vessel did not run aground, nor should she strike another vessel, but rather sank as a result of a powerful storm on Lake Superior. Approximately 2 years earlier than that, a Swedish merchant ship broke up and sank in the North Atlantic. The ship I served on, the USS Independence, responded to the distress call and turned into the storm to see if there were any survivors. Now understand that this ship was huge. It's 1,000 feet long, it's 400 feet wide, it has a crew of 5,000 men, carried 90 airplanes on board. It's one of the most powerful vessels in the face of the earth. She's capable of speeds well in excess of 30 miles per hour on the open sea. And yet, no matter how big and how powerful she was tossed about as a cork in the North Atlantic. The flight deck on an aircraft carrier of that size is about 100 feet above the surface of the water. And we had waves breaking over the flight deck. That's how powerful the storm was. Probably the only time in my life I was frightened while I was aboard that ship. And I was indeed frightened. It threw me out of my bunk, so powerful were the waves striking the ship. Well, we made it. And we actually picked up one survivor out of that storm and brought him back alive. I tell you those things, not as a history lesson, I'm sure most of you are aware at least of the Edmund Fitzgerald, but rather to point out the power and the terror that a storm at sea can bring. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Our text is, as Jeff read for us, Mark, the fourth chapter, verses 35 through 41. But the story is also told in Matthew, the eighth chapter, and Luke, the eighth chapter. We're going to look into Mark's version of this incident for a few minutes this evening. Do that. The geography around the Sea of Galilee, or the Sea of Tiberias, or Gennesaret, or any of the other names that it's known by is unique, and we want to talk about that here in a few minutes. That's why there's a map up there that Steve very graciously found for me. The book of Mark itself records many of the miracles of Christ. Many believe that it was specifically written and addressed to the Romans, who were basically in charge of everything in the Mediterranean basin at that time, because they recognized the power that it had. And it's written from Rome, the city of Rome, to Romans in that regard. It's one of what's referred to frequently as the three synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's kind of unique in that regard. It emphasizes this book, the book of Mark, the power of Christ. Most scholars believe it was written by John Mark, who we read of in other places. He probably wrote it as a result of his close contact with the Apostle Peter. At least that's what those who are much more scholarly than I think. So it's possibly true. It was probably written between 62 and 67 AD. It has a freshness and an originality that the other three Gospels do not have in that. Its purpose is kind of unique. It breaks down into three phases very conveniently. It talks about Galilee and Christ's ministry there, It then goes on to the transition to Judea, the ministry there, and then it, final third of it, refers to what's frequently called the Passion Narrative or the Passion Week. It provides to those to whom it was addressed an assurance that they have placed their faith in a powerful individual, the Son of God, and it demonstrates to them this great power that he had. It takes place in Galilee. Now, Galilee was considered to be a backward place, especially if you were in Jerusalem or you were a member of the Sanhedrin. It was that. It's in this region up in here, right about here, commencing just south of Lake Hula and coming on down, probably into here. Okay? And it's centered around the Sea of Galilee. Now, despite the fact that it was considered to be a backwoods, it was a very bustling community. There were several large and active cities around the edge of the Sea of Galilee. And one of the primary industries, as we've seen here, was fishing. And we know that at least four of Christ's disciples made their living by fishing and apparently made a reasonably good living. We know that John's family had servants and that his family was known in the offices of the high priest. So we know that he at least, had some influence and it was a reasonably, we won't say rich, but at any rate was reasonably well-to-do in that day and time. The sea right here, Sea of Galilee, is about 13 miles long. It's a freshwater sea. It's 8 miles wide at its widest point. It's 150 feet deep. And it's fish abound there. You can even go fishing today if you want to in the Sea of Galilee, and you probably would catch some fish out there. I think you could probably even catch a fish called St. Peter's fish. I don't know what St. Peter had to do with it, but at any rate, they tell me that that's one of the species of fish that's available in that, The most unique thing about the Sea of Galilee is that its surface is almost 700 feet below sea level. Here's the Mediterranean Sea, here's the Sea of Galilee. It is 700 feet lower than the Mediterranean. That's a big drop. It also is very hot in the summer and reaches temperatures well in excess of 100 degrees in the months of July, August, and probably on into September. And that makes it very unique indeed. Through there. The geography around it is also kind of unique. There's a huge dip in the Earth's surface that runs starting south of Mount Hermon, running through the Hula Valley to Lake Hula, down the Jordan River, to the Sea of Galilee, on down the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. And it's a huge gap, one of the lowest places on the surface of the earth other than the oceans, of course, through that. So here, if you can see very closely, you'll see a mountain ridge that lies through the center of Palestine, runs right through here. Jerusalem sits on that mountain ridge. So as you go down through here, you have a mountain ridge. It's about 4,000 feet in altitude, 4,000 feet above sea level. You have Mount Hermon, which is about 10,000 feet above sea level, and is often snow-covered, as you can see there in the white. Now, we get to why that's important. And the reason it's important is when the winds come off the Mediterranean Sea, they're full of moisture. When they hit this area here, they have to go up and they cool. When they come down off of that, and they hit the Sea of Galilee with the moisture that's hanging over it in its tropical climate, they produce violent storms, and they produce it without warning. If the winds come from the northeast out of Mount Hermon, they come down even further, and they come down through these canyons, and they hit the Sea of Galilee, and they produce the violent storm that we read about here. There's one other instance in the New Testament where we learn of these storms that come down through here. And they are quick, and they are violent, and like the other storms that we've talked about, they are deadly. And that's where Christ and his disciples are. They're crossing this sea. They're going from someplace around on the western side, they're going to the eastern side. He has just preached to thousands of people over here, and now he apparently wishes to take a break and sail across, perhaps from Capernaum, perhaps from another place. But at any rate, they sail across this sea, and it's night. And this storm hits. And when it hits hard. Now understand that at least four of the disciples are seasoned sailors. Okay, they made their living fishing on this lake. They know this lake like the back of their hand, and they are terrified. The waves are breaking over the edge of the ship. It's filling up with water, and it can sink. And if it sinks, it's a long way to swim. And that terrifies even the most seasoned of sailors among them. And that is a frightening thought. I believe that this, in my mind, is the most awe-inspiring miracle that Christ ever works. If you can control this violent storm by merely uttering, "Peace be still," you are indeed the Son of God. You are indeed the powerful individual that these people will believe in. And I believe that's the reason why this story is recounted in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. You have this tremendous power, and he uses it, and then he kind of chides his disciples, saying, "This isn't going to happen. I appreciate greatly the songs that Ron led for us, especially the last one, where the song points out just exactly what these verses tell us in that, and what Mark tells us when he said, 'Peace be still,' it was still. And it became calm. The wind stopped, the sea stopped churning, and they were saved. That's powerful indeed. But this evening, I want to point out something that's even more powerful than that. If you look at John, the third chapter, and verses 16 and 17, we read what that is. And that text says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." Understand that I believe that's the most powerful miracle or sign that Christ was ever involved in. Because as a result of his birth, his ministry, his suffering and death on the cross, and his resurrection, we've been given the greatest gift that can be given, the most powerful thing that Christ ever did, was to provide us with the possibility of spending eternity with him. That's even more powerful than calming the waves. That's more powerful than raising someone from the dead. More powerful from healing people at a distance. More powerful than certainly turning water into wine. But it's the thing that we can rely upon. Okay? We've been given that opportunity to do that. And that, to me, and I believe quite appropriately to all of us, is a representative of the enormous power that Christ has demonstrated for us. So what is our response to that? Well, you have two alternatives. That's all. You can either believe it, and you can obey what God has told us to do, or you can reject it. No other choice. You got A and you got B. And if you don't take A, you're stuck with B. And that's what Christ has given us. He demonstrated his power on earth with all of the miracles that he did. But he demonstrated even greater power when he provided us with salvation. Now, you have an opportunity tonight to accept those terms. And we'll help you with that. Or if you've already done that and have somehow fallen away, you got an opportunity to correct that tonight as well. You may have other opportunities. If you don't take advantage of the night, I certainly hope that you do, but you don't know that. So you have the chance to take advantage of this great gift, of this great powerful miracle that God has provided for us through his Son. We can help you in any way that this good book allows. Please come as together we stand and sing our song.
Will you come with me?